Hello, and thank you for listening to the Saturday Morningstar Men's Podcast. Let's get right into this week's message.
With something that we could get some students involved with. Work projects are sometimes for guys a good way to build relationships. So let's really look at doing this. All right, a couple of notes about where we're going. This was supposed to be the first week in our Honest Conversation series. I've put that on hold for a week. So today we're going to talk about an independent, isolated topic. I've just called it questions. And we'll get into that in a minute. Couple of things coming up. We have a good series planned for the fall. We're going to build it based on the book Manly Men. And here's our goal. 100 guys in small study groups meeting throughout the week. Homes, diner, maybe here. 100 men. And I think we can do this.
20 leaders of these groups.
Right. So some of you, are you ready for this? Some of you are going to be group leaders. That's almost a given. And since we've already invested significantly in a number of you, some of you are ready to be group leaders. So this is a good growth opportunity. And this is probably what I would call the biggest and most intentional plan to get guys connected that we have had thus far. So this should be a really good study. I've read through the whole book. I think John has read through the whole book. There's some really engaging stories. This is not dry stuff. This is really interesting, exciting stuff. And I think it speaks to absolutely every man. So we're looking forward to doing this. It'll start the end of September and run for 8 weeks. All right, enough about that. So let's get into our topic for the morning. I'm going to send some handouts or a handout sheet around. I'm just going to ask you to flip the handout over on its back and not worry about what's written on it. What I'd like you to do for the time that we're here this morning is just focus on your thoughts. Jot down your ideas, your reflections on what's being talked about, and then the list of questions, it's on the front side. You can look at them later. Does anybody need a pen? Anybody else? Who did I miss? All right. Anybody else? Okay. We got a few more here. We're good, John. Did everybody check the pen that I handed them to make sure that it writes? Okay, so let me tell you how this is going to work this morning. The talk is going to be divided into two halves. We said it's already, it's the power of questions. So the first half, we're going to look at why questions matter. What kind of person I will have to become if good questions are going to matter to me. And then finally, at the end of that, we're going to look at some, what I feel are some helpful questions. So let me tell you a little bit about how this developed and why we're doing this morning instead of what was planned. A few weeks ago, I was listening to a podcast. Dave Ramsey, every week, his team puts together a podcast, and it's primarily geared toward business people. Typically, members of his staff organize this recording. They interview people. They interact with each other in the studio. It's some good material, but every once in a while, somebody good comes through town that they want to grab a hold of while they're in town, and it turns out that this time, Dave Ramsey met with Mark Cuban. Anybody know Mark Cuban by name? Okay, well, for those of you who don't, he got his start in, we'll call it online broadcasting. That's where he made his fortune, in starting to stream games, basketball games, I think maybe football games online. So the way I understand it, if you were a passionate fan of a college team in a certain town and you moved somewhere, you could no longer get broadcast for that game. But he, through his technology creation, allowed people that were fans anywhere in the country to follow games. And I think later on he sold it for some substantial sum. He's now a majority shareholder in the Dallas Mavericks. If you followed that at all, you know he's kind of a controversial figure. He's very outspoken, whereas most owners tend to be a little bit aloof and sit up in the box. He's right down there with the players, right down there courtside. And very definitely outspoken. I think I read just the other day he had something in excess of $1 million in personal fines that he had accumulated for violating various courtesy rules and I think cussing referees out a few times and things like that. So he's a very passionate guy. Well, Dave sits down and interviews him. And in the process of the interview, and I should tell you a little bit about Ramsey's organization. How many of you are familiar with Dave Ramsey? And what do you know Dave for?
Money management.
Okay, personal money management. But as much as the Ramsey organization is known for personal money management tools, they also have an entire division that's geared towards small businesses, medium-sized businesses. They bring people in from around the country and they provide for them like a week's worth of personal coaching and some really intense training. So they have an organization comprised of about 300 staff people, various trainers, etc. So Dave is successful in his own right. So here we have two very successful, very experienced business people sitting down in a room and they're just swapping stories and interacting with each other. And sometime during that 45-minute discussion, Mark says to Dave, "Well, why do you still work?" And it's a really profound question that sort of lingers in the air for a moment. So neither of them needs to work. They could both cash out and live comfortably, buy a small island in the Caribbean somewhere, either of them probably, and live out the rest of their lives. And so Mark says, "So why do you still work? Why do I still work?" And we're going to come back to that question in a few moments. But the idea of asking important questions is what stuck with me there. So we're going to look for the rest of the first half of this at how do we ask ourselves good questions and do good questions matter? So here's a short list. Good questions make us think. Good questions motivate and challenge. Have you ever been moved by an excellent question? Have you ever been angered by a question? And I want to make it clear here, there's two different kinds of questions. There's the question that's sort of rhetorical in nature, the kind that you ask your kids when they should have known better. And you're really not asking them because you want information from them. It's really like a different way of saying, "I thought I told you to, but you didn't." But you pose it as a question, so it sort of masquerades as something that it really isn't. So we're not talking about those kinds of questions. We really are talking about questions that seek an answer. How many of you have experienced this? One good question, carefully thought about and answered, leads to another question and leads to another and leads to another. And in the process of that, breakthrough discoveries are made. So if you're not willing to ask meaningful questions, it's improbable that you're ever going to arrive at breakthroughs in your life. So to help us appreciate why this is important, have you ever been, or maybe not have you ever been, but right now, are you stuck in some area of your life? Is there something that isn't working right in your life? Is there a relationship that isn't going well? Are you happy with your finances? I don't mean ecstatic with your finances, like we could always use a little bit more money, but that's not what I mean. Are you generally pleased with the direction and the purpose of your life? I know I'm starting to ask questions, which is not what I intended to do, but this is the power of good questions. And if we don't have good questions, actually reveal something about our hunger. So as a matter of fact, if you have no questions going on, it begs the question, do you actually have any passion or hunger inside of you? Or have you become so indifferent and so we'll say it, just lazy, that you're just coasting. I want to talk for a minute about two different kinds of thinking that we often engage in. We'll call it reactive thinking and then proactive thinking. And I heard this phrase used to describe a political leader recently. And he was accused of being reactionary in his thinking. So what do you suppose that means? Yes, that everything in his leadership style was a problem happens and I have to have a response. Now every one of us finds that, right? We cannot see into the future. So chances are every one of us has been a reactionary leader during the past week. Something comes up, we have to respond. But if all we ever are reactionary people, then what influence do we have over life? As opposed to being a proactive thinker who tends to get out in front of the problem. And I think this is one of the dilemmas that sometimes in the church we face, where we're so busy fixing problems that we don't necessarily have time to think about the direction that we would like to take culture. And so as a matter of fact, what has happened is culture has taken us to the point where we become constant and chronic problem solvers, always reacting to the next need in the community. And there's nothing wrong with that. But if we're not spending equal time being proactive in our thinking, asking the good questions about where we might want to go, then we're constantly in reactive mode. Have you ever been in one of these situations in life where it's just one thing after another comes at you and you never feel like mentally you can gain your balance? Like you're living all of your life off balance and it feels chaotic? And I think that's what happens when we're constantly in reactive mode. So the next big thing, I'd like you to just write down that reactive and proactive. Give some thought to that this week. Give some thought to that over the next month. What kind of person are you by nature? And I suspect by now that a couple of you, you've come out here and you're expecting to have a Bible study and you're perplexed by why we're talking about this. And the reality is that what we say again and again is, we have a life study here. So if you're new here, if this is your first time here, second time here, you've never heard that phrase, what we say is we have conversations about the convergence or the intersection of your life and what the Scripture has to say about your life, your challenges, your situations. And so when Scripture is taught at a point that is not at the intersection of your life, it has no bearing on your life, it has no meaning, and you don't do anything with it. So sometimes we have to pause and just talk about our lives so that we understand where we are, so we understand what the intersecting point might be. How many of you have ever asked this question, I wonder what God's will is for my life? All right. How many of you have ever delayed making a decision, agonized over a decision? We might even accuse you of being indecisive in a decision because you were waiting to discover the will of God. Has that ever happened to anyone in the room? I'd like to give you a different picture to look at for the morning. I'd like you to imagine, and you can actually draw this on the back side of your page. You probably still have a little bit of real estate left there. Draw a circle, big or small as you want it to be. Let that circle represent your will. All right, when you're done with that circle, draw a larger circle. Huh? A larger concentric circle so as to encompass the baby circle. You making fun of me? Yes, Jim. Would you like to hold that up for everyone to see? Very good.
Put it on the fridge.
All right. So if that smaller circle represents your will, let the larger circle represent God's will. And so in that sense, now this is going to surprise some of you, in that sense, you cannot act outside the will of God. It doesn't mean you act within the favor or the pleasure of God, but you cannot act outside the will of God because there are boundaries. Remember the garden story? Adam and Eve got too far outside the will of God, and God steps into the situation and says, nope, you're not going to do that here anymore. We have a new home for you. It's called outside the garden. And we have a new set of rules and conditions that you're going to operate by, because you didn't operate well by the old rules, and so I'm going to step in and I'm going to adjust things. There's examples of that throughout Scripture. So technically speaking, it is impossible to operate outside the will of God. Not the pleasure of God, not the favor of God. Those are different issues. Here's the question that we should all consider carefully. God has done everything possible to give us each will and choice. Are you taking advantage of that? Are you really acting proactively, aggressively, intentionally to exert what God has given you? Or are you sitting back and being somewhat indifferent to it? I want you to think about the great, tremendous cost to all of humanity that has been paid in order to preserve our right to choose. Our right to choose has been responsible for a lot of pain in life. Would you agree with that? Why? If your ability and your right to choose is not important to God, we have very little in the way of substantive explanation for a lot of the pain that occurs in life, because it could have been eliminated. And so if God has gone to such great extent to give us the right to choose, and of course to choose wisely and choose well, are we using that gift to the fullest? And some of us want God to make choices that God has already said that is your choice to make. Take that idea with you. The next thing that is my dream and my hope for here, so we'll talk about all of us together, is that we become what I'll refer to as a learning community. And in a learning community, the people who come into it interact with each other and they seek to discover new and better ways to do things. New and better ways to live as community. New and better ways to interact with the larger community in which we live. Are we a learning community, or are we just a passive and static absorb information community? Are you having conversations with other men throughout the week? And are they inspiring you to think more broadly? Or you them? So this is important stuff. You heard Bob say just a few minutes ago that there's this problem going on over here and that problem going on over here. And frankly, do you know what? Bob didn't touch on a fraction of the problems. He didn't talk about our own country's southern border and all that's going on there. He didn't talk about Israel. He didn't talk about, help me out, I don't know, what am I missing? He didn't talk about the thousands upon thousands of problems that exist in this world and are begging for solutions. And sometimes you and I sit here and we pretend that we are powerless to do anything more than live ordinary lives. And yet the amazing thing is that almost every great thing that happens, happens when an ordinary person does something. You know why we don't think they're ordinary anymore? Because they stepped outside their ordinariness and did something. They were just ordinary people until every one of the heroes in this book was an ordinary individual. There was nothing unique or special about any of them. Why do we know about Abraham? What distinguishes Abraham from the tens of thousands of other men that lived at that time and that general place? He exercised an option and chose to act in a certain way. He was given an invitation to act, and he acted on the invitation. That's the only reason we know this guy. Maybe you've never thought of it this way, but do you suppose that it's possible that God extended the invitation to other people and they turned him down? Have you and I received invitations and we've turned them down? And what does an invitation look like, incidentally? Because I think if we're all waiting for God to throw up the neon billboard and say, "Hey, you, I want you to do this," that's probably not going to happen. This is why I say one of the power of questions is to give us the ability to look at the world around us, right around us. Say, why is this thing this way and should it remain this way? All right, so what kind of person do I have to be if questions are going to matter to me? All right, so for a moment, you can turn your paper over. Just for a moment. Bottom of the page, your page, should be something that reads about like this. Pride and humility are two soils of the mind. One, humility is conducive to the sowing of new ideas. It permits those ideas to take root and grow. Pride, the other soil of the heart, is already filled. It has not room for new things. And so, so far, so good. You and I are soil. Is there room in you for new ideas? Are you good soil into which good ideas, new ideas, could be sown? So what are some of the conditions of good soil? Let's just make this practical. What are some of the conditions of good soil?
Open to new ideas.
Real ground. Real soil. I'm not being metaphorical for the moment. I'm being literal. What are some of the qualities of good soil?
Retains water and also drains.
Yes, it does. All right. So it is able to hold something that lives will need, right? It's able to retain that. Okay, so it's able to hold water, but the right amount of water. What else?
Has the right chemicals to have growth.
Okay. So it's able to hold a lot of the right kind of stuff. In other words, it is a favorable environment in which something can grow. Which means, of course, it's not too hard, right? Can't be rock. Can't be mostly rock. So it's loose enough also that roots can spread out. Mentally speaking, what are some of the qualities of good soil? Now we're metaphorical. Now you've stepped over. Now you're the gardener. This is the interesting thing about us as people. We are both the soil in that analogy that Jesus uses, but we are also the gardener. As the soil, I can absorb anything. If I'm good soil, I can permit anything to grow, right? The difference between good soil and not good soil is not that something will grow in it. In good soil, anything can grow. As attested to by your flower beds that have weeds in them, right? But as the gardener, what's my responsibility?
Weed.
Okay.
The soil will filter. The soil filters. And if it brings the soil, it filtering is more of a habitual or can be established. Now, I'm just, you said earlier, questions lead to change. My brain, if I'm just sort of accepting stuff or ignoring stuff all the time, that habit stops me from going. You said taking questions, being a learning person or learning community, that's a habit that you develop, and it's a brain function. I think more than like a gardener thing, more than an action. Your brain has to be pliable in that direction. It can be exercised.
Okay, we'd say it this way, you must be attentive to what's growing. You must be attentive to what's being planted. You must be attentive to how it's being planted. And if you want to take another one of Jesus' stories, he says that some people come to the owner of the land and they say, it looks as if when we were not paying attention, something else was planted in our field. We planted good stuff, but there's this not so good stuff growing. What do you want us to do about that? How does the not so good stuff get there? Well, we're surrounded by the not so good stuff. Let's be real. We are surrounded by both good stuff and not so good stuff. And if we're not careful, if we're not alert, then we just let anything and everything take root. That makes us ineffective gardeners. In a learning community, when we come together and we are honest and alert not only about what's going on in our own lives, but in the lives of others, how do we tell when bad stuff has been planted? Do you know when bad stuff has been planted in the lives of your kids? Come on. How do you know?
See it.
Yeah, you do. You see it. Subtle hints in their conversation. Attitudes. Small behaviors. Have you ever watched a child and you could say it looks as if good stuff has been planted in him? Of course. Here's an important question. What constitutes good seed? And the danger in being in a church environment is to assume that there is a very small and limited quantity of good seed. Is there good seed that can come from the world around us? Are there good messages? Of course there are. So a careful gardener needs to be discerning, but not inherently suspicious. There's something else that a good gardener does. It's to care for and nurture the small ideas that just start to grow. Now, I want you to think about all the great ideas that you have had. And I don't mean ideas to build a new widget or something like that. I want you to think about the good relational ideas you had. I'm going to do this for my family or with my family, or we're going to try to do that. How many good ideas die a quick death because of lack of attention? If you were to make a list of all the great ideas you had about the good intentions that you had toward your family, toward a business opportunity, toward one thing or another, that you didn't ultimately act on, how long would that list be? Why? And admittedly, we're humans. We can only do so much. So a certain amount get filtered out simply because we can only act on so many good ideas. But I think for many of us, it's not that we can't act on an additional idea. What gets in the way? We're going to look at that later on. There's some things really get in the way of us being able to act out on good ideas that we have. All right, questions are good because questions assume something or a number of things from us. Now, when I ask a person a question, I assume that they have what? The capability, perhaps, to ultimately deliver an answer. Doesn't mean that they have the answer right away. When I ask myself a question, what does it say about me? What does it assume about me?
The ability and cognitive process to be able to come up with an answer.
Yes. I've met people who don't trust themselves to ever have an answer. So have you. And so they say, I don't know. See, when your 10-year-old says, I don't know, and doesn't want to pursue an answer, you can forgive him. Or you direct him to the dictionary or the encyclopedia or Wikipedia or whatever it is that you direct them to, and you say, I think you could find an answer. But when you're 40 and you say, I don't know, and I don't think I have the capability to find out, what does that say? You've given up. You're lazy. Where does hopelessness come from? Where does a spirit of oppression and hopelessness that says all hope is lost, I'm doomed, I'm sunk, where does that come from?
Tried a few times, it didn't happen, you start to believe there isn't an answer. It's not going to happen.
So just, is anybody there? Today, is anybody there right now? Is that where you are? Have you come to the conclusion that there are no answers for the problems that plague you? Have you come to the conclusion that the good things that maybe you at one time felt God had called you to are impossible to achieve and therefore you have to abandon them? Is that where you are now? Now here's an interesting one. This should liberate every one of us. A good question doesn't obligate you to action. You can discover the answer to something and decide that you don't want to act, don't need to act. Many of us feel like as if we serve God because we have to. When you wake up tomorrow morning, you can say, I choose to do this. I don't have to do this. Even when you're in the middle of a difficult situation and you might rather lie on a beach in the Caribbean, but instead you're here having to grapple with some tough stuff, you can say, I choose to do this, because you understand the other choices and their outcomes. If I were to ask you this question, what is the feeling of secure power that you have, power over life circumstances? Do you feel as if you are reasonably in control to the degree that a human should be in control? Do you feel that you are in control of your life, or is your life in control of you? All right. I want to move on to the dozen questions now. Some of these are old favorites of mine. A few of them are new. This first one, you can say it in a number of different ways, so I'm just going to ask you to turn the paper over. Don't worry about what's written on the paper anymore. We're just going to, let's interact here. If it were possible for you to choose this, would you hire you again today to run your life? Hey, you are the manager of your life. So if there was such a thing as two different yous, and one of you was the chairman of the board, you were responsible for your life's output, your life's direction, your life's results. And then there was another one of you that was the CEO of your life. And the two of you were to have a meeting one day. Would you continue to keep you and your employ to run your life? Or are you very dissatisfied with the output of your life? Now that sounds really silly, but the truth is, exactly like we are soil and gardener, we live with both the output of our life, but we are determiners of what that output is. And unfortunately, as much as we might like to blame other stuff and blame bad relationships and blame the circumstances that came into our life, none of that is necessarily false. But still, you have a great deal of ability to determine the direction, the quality, the tone of your life. Would you fire yourself today and get somebody new to run your life? Or are you happy with your management? Let's move on to question number two, which is the question that we left off with that I said was the great question that Mark Cuban post. How hard are you working beyond what it takes to provide for your needs, your financial needs? Why do you get up and go to work every day? If you had all the money that you needed in life, would you still continue to work? And if so, why? And if so, at what? And what I want you to get your heads around here is, do you feel that what you do matters? Or is it just a means to a paycheck? Because I think one of the contentment measures of life is, do I do work that in the end I feel makes a difference to humanity? Or am I just in it for the bucks? Because something as important, and how many of you spend at least 7 or 8 hours a day at work 5 days a week, right? Okay, so if we say that you work 40 hours a week, give or take 160, 170 hours a month, I don't know what that translates to by for a year, but it starts to add up to be a lot of hours, doesn't it? Wouldn't you want to know that that much of your life actually mattered? Or asked a different way, how could a person feel significant and purposeful if the primary output of their life was something they felt didn't matter? Do you understand what I'm saying? Now, I don't want us all to leave here depressed, but sometimes people stay in bad situations long after they have to. Yes, Brian.
This question and the two before, at the core of it, more than like having meaningful employment, you know, feeling that my job means something, that what makes it my life is freedom. I have the freedom to choose. These millionaires, they're going to work every day. It's their choice. They're owning that life. They, you know, they could be beach ball. They could learn to surf. You know, whatever. They don't have to. They're choosing.
That actually sounds fun, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The learning to surf part.
Yeah. But we think of, oh, they're millionaires. They can choose. Your questions start, why do you go to work every day? I choose to go to work. Call up and say, I'm not coming in today. You know, I had to face the consequences of that. I don't have the $1 million in the bank that I don't need to do that days had. But I still choose that. It's my choice each and every day. Each of your questions, I have to choose. I have to own my life. And having the freedom to see that these are my choices, that this is what I'm choosing to do. I'm managing my life in a state of freedom. That, okay, I gotta go to work. I don't have to go to work. But believing that lie is what leads to hopelessness. That I have to do this, I have to do that, I have to get to church, I have to pray, I have to read the Bible, I have to pay my taxes, I have to brush my teeth. Everything have to is a slavery. God doesn't want us to be slaves. He wants us to be interactive, free participants in what He has for us. You know, like this life, my will inside of His will, He wants that to flourish. He wants good things. He's pouring the fertilizer. He's tilling the soil of my life. He wants me to know that my roots can grow this way and that way. I can be firmly entrenched in this life. And it can be good, no matter what it is. You know, if I'm cashier problem. It can be good. It should be good. The CEO of some basketball team. Now LeBron James wanted to play for me.
All right. Any other thoughts before we move on? All right. Next question. Now we're going. Yes. Sorry.
Just a thought when you said about if you were the CEO of you, would you hire you back? It, life, even if you feel that you're passing it off to other people, the question is, are you a good CEO or a bad CEO? Because you can give it free choice, period.
Can I answer that?
Yeah.
The hope in answering that question is, if you fired you today, and you were the chairman of the board, what would you have to do immediately?
Shoot yourself in the head.
Well.
Find a replacement.
You'd have to find a replacement. Thank you. Your answer is so much better than his.
That's not enough.
But
the way you want to look at it. You need to look at it like you're talking about. Yes.
You would have to find a replacement. And what would you be looking for as the qualities of the replacement? And this is the second question and the third question that builds on the first question. Okay, well, if I don't like the results of my life, if I don't like the way I'm managing my life, what would I need to become as a manager in order to keep myself employed as the manager of my life? I said it would sound like a silly question unless you took it deep enough to really probe and say, okay, what's missing in my life? Okay. Now, let's make it practical. Let's go on to the third question. What have you done with the knowledge that you've acquired in the last several months? And I say this is a really important question that relates directly to question number one. In the last 90 days, can you think of two or three oh wow moments that you have had? I didn't know that. That's an amazing idea. Can you think of at least one of them? Okay, look, people, lie to me now, okay? Somebody has to have had an oh wow moment in the last... I'll bet you I have 3 oh wow moments a day. Can I tell you? I don't use most of them. I look back on my life a week after I've had an oh wow moment and I have some profound discovery and I think, well, I need to integrate that into my life. And I have to ask myself sometimes this really tough question. Have I done anything with what I've discovered? See, if we are going to be a learning community and if we are constantly having small or large oh wow moments, our lives should start to look different. Like if somebody met you today and then they didn't meet you for another 3 years, in a certain sense, they should almost not be able to recognize who you are from your thinking and your conversation. We should be new. We should be different. And if we're not, what does that say about what we're learning? We're either A, not using what we've learned, or here's another one. Are you learning things that don't matter? Is it possible that you've filled your life with absorbing information that's really essentially useless? You wouldn't call it trivia. Let me ask you a question. How much time do you spend ingesting the daily national news? Some? A lot? Some of you, none. There's real news junkies in the world. They fill their lives with what's happening today. But it's not necessarily going to help them. So the question is, if you want to be a better manager of your life, are you learning the things that are necessary? Do you even know what you should be learning? Let me come back to that question number one again. Because if we're honest, I think we all know where we're failing ourselves. It's not a mystery. Do you know right now one thing where you are disappointed with your performance in life? Could you put your finger on one? I don't like who I am in this area. I'm very dissatisfied with my ability to do this or that or the other thing. And if that's true, what do you need to learn? What do you need to change in order to be more effective at that? All right, next question, unless somebody has a comment. Do you understand the important outputs of your life? And one of those outputs is certainly money, right? You go to work, you do something, you get money for it. You have relational outputs. You have creative outputs. Are the products that your life is producing, if your life were a company, are the products that your life is producing valuable? Are they durable? Are they lasting? Are you sowing the seeds of who you are and your output into the lives of other human beings who will live on? Are you creating things that will matter to people later on? Here's one of the measures of this. If we say that human beings last and human beings matter, then how much of your life or mine will either directly or indirectly improve the quality of life, either internally or externally, of other people? You know what the difference between overhead and profit is, right? A lot of us spend a lot of our lives in personal overhead. We enjoy this, we want to do that, and so we spend a lot of the output of our lives on our own enjoyment. Now, I'm not against enjoying your life, but it's the difference between a company that has marble in the foyer and one who has plain materials. Is your life filled with marble that is really extravagance, that is unnecessary? Are you consuming too much of the output of your life on yourself? And that's an important measure that we all have to reevaluate from time to time. Number five is another question that's directly related to question number one. This is actually a favorite of mine that I ask myself from time to time. How many of you would say that you have a number of patterns or habits for the way you live your daily life? And I'm not talking brush your teeth. That's a good one, but I'm not talking. I'm going a little deeper than that. Hopefully taking a shower is in there. That's one of those regular habits as well. Again, not talking about that. Do you have regular habits that you feel are serving you well? And when is the last time you did a habit inventory to see if the habits of your life are still the best ones at this season of your life? So I'll give you an example. I've shared with you a number of times that I start typically every day, give or take an hour of reading, something like that. Sometimes it's a little more, sometimes it's a little less. But from time to time, I have to ask myself, is this the best use of my time? And there's times when, now that I have established that habit and I know that I can walk away from that habit for a day or two and I'm not in danger of losing it, I have to say to myself, you know what, today I need to be more concerned with output than input. Today, maybe I only input for a half an hour because I believe there are necessary outputs and there's not enough time in the day, and therefore I have to focus more on output than input. But if I'm not attuned to my habits, and if I'm not willing to ask myself regularly, are my habits still serving my best interest and the interest of my purpose for living? If those habits are not serving the purpose for my living today, then they need to be adjusted. And here's the thing. As we enter new seasons in life, take an inventory of your life very quickly. Are you in a different season than you were a decade ago? Your responsibilities different? Your surroundings look different? The expectations placed on you by others, are they different? Have you acquired new habits that will serve this new season in your life? Or are you still living with the habits that you acquired 20 or 30 years ago and you haven't done anything to change them? All right, question number six, and this is kind of a fun one. At least I think it's fun. Is there something new that you need to do that might help you to learn in a new way? Do you need to take up a new sport, a new hobby? Do something entirely different. Because in doing that something different, you might see all of life differently. You might gain some new understandings. And this is where this and question number five are intimately connected. Is there something that's come into your mind in the last year and you say, I would love to? And then you've said, but I don't have the time. Is there a habit that you've acquired? Is there something that you're pursuing now and maybe you just keep pursuing it because, I don't know, because it's part of your life? Do you need to let go of something old so that you can pick up something new? And I don't know about you, but I have learned some really great lessons for life by pursuing some new interest at times. It's amazing how trying to learn something new forces you to think in a way that you're not accustomed to thinking. And then that skill set transfers into every other area of your life and everything you have to do. All right, now we're going to take the questioning a completely different way. What are the one or two important questions that you are probing the scriptures for right now? Do you have a question that you would love to sit down with God and chat about? Is it something about yourself? Is it something about life? Is it something about your purpose? When you go to the scriptures, whenever that is, are you on a hunt for something or do you just hope for the best when you open the book? Question number 8, if I really truly believe that I would never have this hour, this day, this week again, how would I live it? Take a personal inventory of your past week. Did you take it for granted? I mean, I know I certainly did. I'm not putting you on the spot here. I know I certainly took many of the moments of my life for granted in the past week. And I didn't treat them as one of a kind, special, unique things. And not every moment of life is wonderful. But every single moment of your life is the one and only time that you will get to have that. And if we forget that, if we lose track of that, it is amazing. Tell me it's not surprising that we're halfway through summer already. No, I mean, really, and I know I sound horribly old when I say it like that, as if, boy, time sure goes quick when you get old. And I don't mean it like that, but isn't it true? I mean, where did the first half of summer go? It was cold? And if we're shocked at how fast a summer can go, what should that tell us about life? And I'm just saying, if we learn this lesson about a season, I think it will be helpful to us when it comes to our life. Make sure that you understand. Make sure you're asking yourself, am I living as if this is a special moment? Because it's the only time you'll live it. And look at y'all, you're wasting it here with me. What's wrong with you? All right, we're going in a relational direction now. I want you to take a moment to think about the most important relationships in your life right now. Put faces to them. Do you know the greatest needs that they have? Hopefully the greatest expressed needs. Do you know the things they're most worried about? Do you know the things that they're most excited about? Do you, in other words, do you really know the people that you're sharing life with, and are you seeking to be an active servant to them, even by just listening to them? I don't do so good at this one. I just got to tell you, which is why I had to put it. Some of these questions are my questions, and you just get to listen in on my having a conversation with myself. So if you don't like my questions, you are free to create your own. Question number 10. And as I have gotten older, I have come to appreciate this as one of the greatest qualities that a human being can have. How flexible are you? Versus how set in your ways are you? If a great opportunity were to come up tomorrow, but you would have to adjust your schedule, Wake up at a different time. Give up something. Do something in a different way. And I'm not talking about leave home and not come back for 8 months. But if a great opportunity were to come up, are you flexible enough that you could take advantage of it? Or would your first response be, but I have this and this and this, and I play bridge on Thursday nights, and I bowl on Tuesday nights. I mean, do you understand what I'm saying? Every single successful person that I have ever met has a degree of flexibility about them that allows them to step outside the routines of their daily life to take advantage of something. And this is true for service as well. See, you and I will never do all the good things that we would like to do, even in terms of serving others, if we're inflexible. Because you're already doing something with all the hours of your day, so if there is no flexibility in you mentally, you can't let go of something so that you can go serve. We can't go paint a house for somebody that needs a house painted because we're already consumed with the things that we have to do. So are you just all overwhelmed, or are you bored, or there's absolutely no comments for the last like 10 minutes here? Really? Okay, that's great. Jim drew two concentric eggs on his page, okay? He's still proud of that. All right, here's the next question. How am I helping those closest to me to discover or rediscover their identity in Christ? Now, I know that sounds like quite a departure from the other questions that we've asked. Let me tell you the origin of this question, and you'll chuckle a little bit. I was driving back from, I guess, seeing my son last week, and a car passes me. And in the car, in the passenger side, is a girl, and she's got red hair. And I don't mean she was born with this hair. I mean, like, Randall's shirt red. Maybe a little bit brighter even than that. Like Jason's shirt, as a matter of fact, yeah. It was red. And I just had to ask myself, and she was young. Why? And that was as far as the question got. Why? What was it about that person that they found so unsatisfactory about themselves, the way they were? What was it about the way they saw themselves that made them think that the only way that they could express themselves to be who they really were was to make their hair red? As if there was no other way to creatively express yourself. And think about this. Was she unique? Is she the only girl with red hair? I mean, in a typical day in Quakertown today, I think you could probably find green hair, blue hair, red hair, right? Isn't that true? And so at a deeper level, it poses a really important question. How do people see themselves, and why is it necessary for them? See, don't they all think that's unique? I'm expressing who I really am on the inside? But if we're all really unique people, if we are made unique, even down to the point of our fingerprints being unique, how is it that so many people independently, all their own choosing, decided to have red hair? That's a really powerful question. Because at the end, what it says is, I have so little personal identity that I need to borrow my identity from somebody else. And this is exactly how powerful understanding who you are in Christ really is. Because if we were created unique, and we are given unique purpose, then shouldn't that express itself in ways that are a lot more powerful than the color of your hair? Now, maybe if the red hair is an important means of doing something more purposeful, more power to you. And I could care less if your hair is purple and red. It doesn't matter to me. But I think people are striving for anything to express themselves simply because they really don't know who they are. This is one of the most powerful ministries that each of us has. is to help people understand how unique and how much they matter, how unique they are and how much they matter. All right. Final question. Am I honestly living as a person who is responsible for his own life, or am I still blaming other people for some of the major problems in my life? Here's the best way to tell. Think of your greatest frustration in life right now. You got a picture? Your biggest disappointment, the thing that upsets you the most, the thing that is prone to make you fly off the handle, if you were the kind of person that was ever prone to fly off the handle. Do you ever say, you know, it would be a lot easier if they would just do their part? It would be a lot easier if so-and-so would just get their act together and then my life wouldn't look like this. Or some variation of that. And you know how I know that that's what people would say if they were not necessarily in total possession of the responsibility for their life? Do you know how I know that? Because I've been prone to say that. And I don't mean when I was 20. I mean, that kind of thing still goes through my mind for a minute, and I have to discipline myself, and I have to stop, and I have to say, wait a minute, that's them. But I still have freedom and choice and power over my own life. And I think it is so, so easy to let others be the excuse that we have for why we're not doing the best or continuing to strive to be the best at what we are. So that's my final question, and now we are free to comment. Hopefully some of that has been some good, useful information to us. We'll be right back.